At the end of April 1902, Edgar received a call from Frank Bassett, a businessman with whom he had become friends. Bassett had been in discussions with Lucien Potter, whose bookstore in Bowling Green was one of the oldest and finest in southern Kentucky. Potter was looking for someone who could help him run the store. Edgar agreed to help Potter on the condition that he could supplement his income by running a small photo studio at the back of the store. Potter loved the idea and hired him before they had even met. Edgar felt happier than he had in years. He not only had his voice back, but the prospect of operating a photo studio in a popular bookstore was everything he could have asked for in a job. As in Louisville, he did exceptionally well. His humble manner and extensive knowledge of store inventory made him an instant success. Edgar took a room at a boarding house where he could live cheaply and walk to work. Mrs. Hollins, the widow who ran it, was a short, stout woman with laughing, twinkling eyes that made everyone feel at home, as Edgar would frequently say. Edgar shared his room with a young doctor, Hugh Beasley, to whom he took an immediate liking. Edgar soon joined the First Christian Church of Bowling Green, where he was later made a deacon. As in Louisville, Edgar became active in the Christian Endeavor and Bible study program and taught an immensely popular Sunday school class. Edgar was doing so well in Bowling Green that he didn't even mind the occasional visits by Al Lane, who would come to treat his voice and would then inevitably conduct follow-up readings on his various patients. At Edgar's request, the purpose of the visits were kept secret. Lane merely introduced himself at the boarding house as a friend and conducted readings in the privacy of Edgar's bedroom when Beasley was not there. Lane kept trying to impress upon Edgar how successful the readings were, but Edgar didn't want to hear any of it. The only reading he gave during this time that had a lasting impact on him was one conducted on behalf of 6-year-old Amy Dietrich, whose reading would become the most heavily researched and documented of Casey's early career. Edgar became involved in the case in early August 1902, when Lane had approached Professor Charles H. Dietrich on a street corner in downtown Hopkinsville. Practically everyone in town had heard about Dietrich's daughter Amy's tragedy. His 6-year-old had a bad case of diphtheria as a toddler, which was believed to have caused her brain to stop developing. Doctors considered her mentally retarded. On the street that day, Lane inquired of Amy's status. When Dietrich said that her condition hadn't improved, Lane volunteered Edgar's services. Dietrich thought the entire idea was patently absurd, but agreed to have Casey give a reading, since he and his wife had tried just about everything else. Lane called Bowling Green, and Edgar agreed to meet him at the Hopkinsville train depot the next morning. Lane met Edgar at the station, and they walked through back alleys to the Dietrich house and then entered the kitchen through the stable. They had taken the circuitous route at Dietrich's request, so that his neighbor, a prominent member of the Presbyterian Church, wouldn't see Edgar entering their house. The child's mother showed Edgar into a playroom where a healthy-looking 6-year-old was on the floor playing with building blocks. A nurse sat near her in a chair, watching. Edgar said hello, but the child barely looked up to meet his eyes. Edgar said he didn't wish to examine Amy, in fact saw no point in doing so because he wasn't a physician. Lane led them into the living room where they spoke to Amy's father and mother for a few minutes before he laid down on the sofa, and Lane guided him into a trance. 20 minutes later, when Edgar woke up, Mrs. Dietrich was in tears. Mr. Dietrich looked to be in a state of shock. He and his wife said they had never seen or heard anything like what they had just experienced. Between her sobs, Minnie Dietrich said, "You've given us the first hope we've had for a normal baby." Edgar asked what he had said, admitting that he hadn't even known what was wrong with the child when Lane called him to their house. According to Mrs. Dietrich, Amy suffered from diphtheria when she was 2 years old, apparently resulting in convulsions in which she would fall down suddenly and her body would stiffen. The convulsions had ended some time ago, but her mind had stopped developing. Although she looked like a healthy 6-year-old, she had the mind of a 2-year-old, and was quickly losing even that. Mrs. Dietrich and her husband had taken her to specialists all over the country. The latest doctor had diagnosed a rare brain disorder that would soon result in death. In trance, Casey had told them that Amy's condition wasn't directly related to the diphtheria. According to him, she had received an injury to her spine before becoming sick. This had occurred as she was stepping down out of a carriage and slipped, injuring her back on the carriage steps. The germs that caused her convulsions had settled in the damaged area along her spine. The body naturally undertook to protect itself by forming a membrane around the damaged area. Over time, this membrane had begun to thicken, and thus impeded the circulation of blood to her head. In trance, Casey recommended that Lane make osteopathic adjustments, which would relax the muscles along her spine and soften the membrane. "Then nature will take its course," he told them. "She will recover." The Dietrichs followed the trance advice, and within 3 months, they had a normal 6-year-old daughter. In the years after that, Amy would grow up strong and healthy, and eventually would graduate at the top of her class in college. The Dietrich reading, more than any other, compelled Edgar to continue working with Lane. It also gave him the first legitimacy he had known since Lane set up his small office in the millinery shop. The Dietrich family never again asked Edgar to enter their house through the stable door. He was treated with the respect and honor accorded a doctor who had saved the life of their child. Mrs. Dietrich wanted to shout Edgar's praises from the rooftops. Instead, she went to the newspapers. Edgar's reaction to the short article that ran in the Hopkinsville Kentuckian was mixed. He was obviously elated that what he had done had been helpful and that others would know about it. However, it brought the kind of notoriety that he knew could be dangerous. Gertrude didn't want to know anything about his trance activities and was horrified by the account in the paper. Edgar's abilities were something that they rarely discussed, and when the subject came up, Gertrude viewed it as an intrusion on their personal lives. She much preferred to daydream about the conventional lifestyle they both yearned for and the wedding they had been planning for the last 5 years. With Edgar's career going so well, preparations were begun for a wedding to be held on June 17, 1903. 300 invitations were sent out. The hill and its adjoining property were put in shape by a team of gardeners, and cooks were hired to help out in the kitchen. The wedding took place as planned, and the day was bright and sunny. The wedding photos show Gertrude looking more radiant than at any other point in her life. By contrast, Edgar, sitting beside her, looks bewildered and almost afraid. After their wedding, Edgar and Gertrude boarded a train back to Bowling Green. The young couple, unable to remain at the singles-only Hollins house, moved into a boarding house directly across the street. They had barely settled in when Lane began calling on Edgar, begging him to relocate back to Hopkinsville, where he envisioned them opening a psychic medical practice. Gertrude wanted the entire matter of Edgar's trance readings kept quiet. She knew there was trouble ahead when Lane showed up a few days after the wedding, during their first Sunday dinner in Bowling Green at the Hollins house. No sooner had Lane arrived than he promptly started into conversation with one of the boarders, O.A. Raup, a circuit court judge and newspaper publisher. Raup, like others at the boarding house, had wondered about Lane's visits and was curious to know what went on when he and Edgar disappeared into his room together. Lane told Raup that he had come to give Edgar therapy for his voice. This answer didn't satisfy Raup, who asked why Casey would consult an unlicensed medical practitioner with a correspondence degree when his best friend, Hugh Beasley, was a specialist. It was there that Lane, perhaps egged on by the insult, told Raup that he had not only put Edgar into a trance and that he cured himself, but that Edgar had also helped cure some of his other patients. Gertrude, who had been listening to the conversation with growing concern, burst into tears and fled from the room. Edgar did not follow her. It seemed to the young bride that her husband valued the work he was doing with Lane more than he shared his wife's concern for the impact it might have on them and their marriage. With so much already said, Edgar was forced to describe their experiments to Raup and the other boarders. He answered questions about the Dietrich case and described some of his earlier childhood experiences. Had the men not known and respected Edgar as much as they did prior to receiving these revelations, they would undoubtedly have thought the claims ludicrous and dismissed Edgar as a fraud. But all the men had witnessed Edgar's honesty and integrity over the past year, and if anyone in the room believed that fraud was involved, such doubts were directed at Lane, not Edgar. Lane suggested they witness a reading for themselves, which they readily agreed to. Edgar went into trance and proceeded to make diagnoses, offer treatments, and conduct follow-up readings on a number of Lane's patients. When he awakened, the room was silent. Edgar's friends looked at him with speculation and wonder. They were astonished at how knowledgeable Casey had appeared to be, and not just in one particular field of medicine, but in all fields. When Edgar returned to his room, he found Gertrude packing her clothes. It took all of Edgar's power of persuasion to convince her to stay. Her concerns were many. The man Gertrude had fallen in love with was gentle and sensitive, with a deep compassion and love of nature and of people. The man who had performed for Blackburn and the others was a mystery, a man with a strange voice that seemed to come out of some dark place. That voice was not that of the Edgar Casey she knew and loved. That strange voice, that other man who emerged when her husband went into trance, brought with it problems that would prevent her and her husband from living the normal life they had both hoped for. This first Sunday in Bowling Green, Gertrude came to recognize that she was not able to have one man without accepting the other. Gertrude's decision to stay in Bowling Green that night was a pivotal moment in their marriage, for no matter what crisis or challenge they would encounter in the years to come, Gertrude steadfastly remained at his side, no matter how difficult things got. And difficult times were right around the corner. Early the next week, they were greeted by the first of two front-page stories about Edgar in the Bowling Green Times Journal, both written by Judge Raup. The Nashville papers picked up the story, and it ran in papers throughout Kentucky and Tennessee. Any thoughts Edgar and Gertrude may have had about remaining anonymous were dashed for good. At work, Edgar was treated with sudden distrust and suspicion, as if he had betrayed Potter's confidence by not letting him in on his secret life as a psychic healer. The young couple was asked to leave the boarding house, and at Potter's request, Edgar was asked to look for another job. Edgar was also asked to leave the First Christian Church of Bowling Green. Al Lane fared no better than Edgar and Gertrude. Not long after the newspaper article ran, he was asked by the state medical board to close his office in Hopkinsville. But with help from Blackburn, he gained entrance to the Southern School of Osteopathy in Franklin, Kentucky, from which he eventually graduated. Lane's entrance to medical school, however, was of only slight consolation to Edgar, and none at all to Gertrude. Edgar and Gertrude were beginning to feel as if their life together was over before it had even begun. In July of 1903, Edgar and Gertrude returned to the Hill, as they would invariably do again and again in the difficult years ahead. Here they could be assured of acceptance, a roof over their heads, and sound advice from three loving and caring aunts who had only the couple's best interests at heart. Gertrude's Aunt Carrie, now married to the debonair Dr. Thomas Burr House, was the first to try and talk sense into Edgar and her niece. Packing their bags and leaving for another city wasn't going to solve their problems, nor would ignoring the special gift that she believed the Lord had given to Edgar. His trance readings, she told Gertrude, would be no more accepted in Bowling Green than in Dallas, Chicago, or anywhere else. The young couple would have to make a life for themselves, despite what others said about them, and there was no reason not to do it in Bowling Green. Carrie and her sisters felt so strongly about Edgar and Gertrude remaining in that city that they mortgaged the hill to raise capital so that Edgar could open his own photo studio. It was a magnanimous gesture that touched Edgar and Gertrude very deeply. Edgar and Gertrude returned to Bowling Green and did everything they could to live up to the family's expectations. In a wise business decision, they chose Frank Potter, a distant cousin of Lucien Potter, Edgar's former employer, as a partner in the new photo studio. On July 22, 1904, using money from the mortgage on the hill together with a lump sum from Potter, they purchased the former Harry L. Cook Studio, Edgar's former competitor. The studio was a financial success from the start, with much credit going to Gertrude's family. They had not only provided the financial backing, but they sent customers too. The first holiday season Edgar was in business, practically everyone who had ever been to the hill gave themselves portraits for Christmas. But Edgar could take some of the credit as well, for many of their clients commented on how well he treated his customers and the skill with which he handled portrait subjects, especially children. Edgar began receiving awards and recognition for his photographs, including first prize in an annual contest sponsored by Ladies' Home Journal. In 1906, he took first place in the National Association of Photographers' National Competition, the highest honor in his profession. The Casey Studio, as it had now come to be known, did such brisk business that its only serious remaining competitor, the Clark Studio on State Street, offered to sell Edgar its studio. Expanding their operations seemed like a good idea, especially since the location of the Clark Studio, directly above Potter's bookstore, provided Edgar and Gertrude the pleasure of succeeding at the same location he had been asked to leave less than 18 months before. Had it not been for Edgar's continued need for treatments for his voice, he might have stopped doing trance readings altogether. But at least once a month, his voice was reduced to a whisper, requiring what were now routine treatments by Lane. Previously, Lane had traveled to see Edgar. Now, Edgar visited Lane, often taking a morning train to Franklin, Kentucky, where Lane was attending medical school. Eventually, Casey decided to stop making trips to Franklin. He turned for help instead to his friend, Dr. John Blackburn. If Lane could put suggestions to him, he figured there was no reason why someone else could not do it. He and Lane had made a small black leather-bound book to write down notes explaining how to conduct one of Casey's trance readings. The first of Blackburn's readings took place in his office. Blackburn read from the black book. Edgar Casey remembered going into trance as he normally did, and upon waking to have his voice back. But when Edgar looked around, he saw Blackburn standing at the door, pale and trembling. As Edgar soon learned, Blackburn had used the opportunity to ask him questions not related to Edgar's voice. Blackburn didn't tell Edgar the questions that he had asked during that trance reading, but the answers had shaken him. This gave Edgar every reason to believe that he had asked questions of a personal nature, things that only Blackburn himself could have known. As a result of this reading, Blackburn became as committed to Edgar as Lane had been. That same day, Blackburn insisted that a team of doctors be assembled to study the phenomena. Edgar agreed without consulting Gertrude. The team of doctors that Blackburn assembled were initially skeptical of their subject's alleged powers, but as a result of a series of experiments, they all quickly became converts. During one of their early tests, a member of the committee chose a piece of paper at random from his safe deposit box, sealed it in an envelope, and placed it in his inside coat pocket. The coat was buttoned, and the doctor put on an overcoat over the jacket. While in trance, Casey reportedly read to them the contents of the document and named the signatures at the bottom. The team of doctors also experimented with Casey's apparent ability to cure himself of his speech difficulties. In trance, Casey was asked to explain how the circulation in his body was changed merely by a command or a suggestion from the person conducting the reading. Casey reportedly lectured the team of doctors on the power of mind over body. As Casey, in trance, would state in thousands of later readings, mind is the builder. The physical is the result. The source, as Lane and now Blackburn had begun to refer to Casey's higher self, had the power of mind control and was the controlling factor in one of the fundamental laws of nature. This was that material conditions in the body can be a direct outgrowth of the thoughts of the individual. As the committee became convinced that Casey truly had special powers, they gave press interviews and arranged demonstrations, all of which generated much publicity. One public demonstration was requested by a Professor Lambert at the Bowling Green Business College, who was interested in a murder that had taken place in his hometown in Canada. The victim had lived with her sister in an elegant home. Police investigators didn't have a suspect or a motive. All the investigators had concluded, based on the available evidence, was that the woman was shot sometime in the afternoon when she was walking down the stairs to the first floor of her house. The trance information said that one sister had killed the other. It also told the name, make, and serial number of the pistol used, its caliber, and the number of empty chambers in it. Furthermore, it stated that the sister, after firing the weapon, threw the pistol out the window into a gutter along the roof, where the pistol slid down the drainpipe and could be found just at the point where the gutter entered the sewer. Lambert sent the information to the chief of police in the Canadian town. Casey's data proved to be so accurate that the chief of police in Bowling Green received warrants and extradition papers for both Casey and Lambert. When the situation was explained to the Canadian official, he requested that a second reading be conducted to describe the motive for the crime. According to the reading, the victim had sabotaged her sister's relationship with a young suitor. She had hidden a love letter in which the man asked for the sister's hand in marriage. The sister found the letter many years later, long after the love of her life had given up hope and left to marry another woman. The Bowling Green police chief sent the report to Canada, and the suspect was confronted with the story. After hearing a description of the reading, she reportedly confessed and was sent to prison. Ironically, just as Edgar Casey had reached a point in his career when he was poised to receive national attention for his trance readings, an untimely series of events caused him to close his photo studios and leave the spotlight. As was the case often in his career, the problems first began with his own declining health. On January 1, 1906, Edgar spent the afternoon in a furniture factory making photographs for a client's mail order catalog. It was a particularly cold day, and there was no heat in the warehouse where Edgar was shooting photographs. It was 7 p.m. by the time he returned to his studio and sat down by the fire to warm himself. No sooner had Edgar sat than he slumped over unconscious, sliding to the floor. Dr. McCracken, who had an office across the street, was summoned, as were Dr. Blackburn and his committee. McCracken, who arrived first, attempted to pour whiskey down Edgar's throat. The photographer's jaws locked and his teeth clenched. In an effort to pry his jaws apart, McCracken broke Edgar's lower front teeth. Other doctors soon began to arrive. Edgar was given an injection of morphine, one of strychnine, and finally one of nitroglycerin. He was wrapped in hot towels, and heated bricks were placed on the bottoms of his feet in an effort to warm him up. But there was no sign of life. Edgar's face had become ashen, and the doctors could not detect a pulse. No one knew what else could be done for him. They covered him with a blanket and pronounced Edgar Casey dead. All of the doctors but McCracken had left by the time Blackburn arrived, wanting to know what had happened. Blackburn became angry, telling McCracken that nothing should have been done. Even if he were well, the stuff you put in him would kill him, Blackburn said. He sat down by the sofa and began to talk to the unconscious Casey. He suggested that Casey wake up, that his blood circulate normally, that his pulse increase. Blackburn talked steadily for half an hour. After 20 minutes, Edgar Casey's muscles began to twitch. His pulse became detectable. Finally, with a groan, he woke up. Pain racked his whole body. His mouth was full of blood. Two teeth were gone, and the bottoms of his feet were burned. Blackburn told him what had happened, and asked what he thought they should do. Edgar told him to put the question to him when he was in trance. Blackburn put him into trance, and, after seeking advice from the source, gave him the suggestion that the poisons in his body not be assimilated, that the burns be healed, and that normal conditions return to all parts of Edgar's body. The area around Casey's arms where the injections had been administered became discolored and swollen, as if the drugs were being held there. Blackburn injected a hypodermic syringe and withdrew the plunger. Most of the drugs came out. Blackburn gave the suggestion for Casey to wake up. He opened his eyes and stretched his arms. He was still sore from head to foot, but most of the severe pain was gone. The next morning, the Caseys were awakened by the doorbell. A messenger was delivering a large floral arrangement. The card began, "With deepest sympathy." Edgar Casey's obituary had appeared in that morning's paper. 4 months later, Edgar was again injured, this time at the hands of the Blackburn Committee. The incident occurred during what was billed as the committee's final experiment, in which physicians from the County Medical Society were invited to witness a reading. Blackburn made the introductory remarks before an audience of 20 or 30 of the state's most distinguished physicians. Edgar was invited onto center stage. He was ushered over to a table and laid down. Blackburn guided Casey into a trance and gave him the name of a patient to diagnose. The patient was a black man who was waiting in the next room for his cue to come inside and be examined by the committee. But the source disappointed everyone by saying that he could do nothing for the man. Later, critics of Casey and the work would claim the reason was racism, that Casey, or the source, didn't diagnose or treat black Americans. This was patently false. Casey provided numerous readings for blacks and other minorities. The most probable reason that a diagnosis was not made was that the source had determined the patient to be incurable, and he literally could do nothing to help him. The demonstration continued when one of the doctors in the audience asked Casey to diagnose a patient he was treating at Potter College, located just outside of Bowling Green. Blackburn gave the suggestion. This time, the information came through. Casey stated that the young man was recuperating from typhoid fever and gave his temperature and pulse rate. Casey then recommended that the patient be placed on a new diet and said that his current treatment was not adequate to facilitate his recovery. As soon as Casey had finished, three physicians were dispatched to Potter College to ascertain whether or not the information was accurate. Upon their return, the doctors reported that the information that had come through was absolutely correct. The patient was indeed recovering from typhoid fever, and his blood pressure and temperature were what Casey had said they were. The report caused much commotion in the Guildhall, prompting other doctors to come onto the stage and test to see if Casey was truly in trance or whether the performance was an elaborate hoax. Blackburn apparently didn't know what they had in mind or didn't react quickly enough to prevent them from their experimentation. Before Blackburn could shield Casey, Dr. William Sadler, a visiting osteopath from Chicago, mounted the stage and drove a long surgical needle into Casey's arm. When this didn't result in the reaction that the doctor expected, the needle was driven into the sole of his foot. Casey still didn't react. In the meantime, another doctor thrust a hatpin through one of Casey's cheeks, while a third ran a penknife under the nail of his left forefinger, slowly lifting the nail away from the flesh. Still, there was no indication of pain, and blood did not flow. The doctors were mystified. When Blackburn gave Edgar Casey the suggestion to end the session, and Casey came out of his trance, he groaned loudly. Blood poured out of his cheek and onto the table. But however painful and humiliating the experience was for Edgar, he kept his anger to himself. The worst he said about his treatment at the hands of the Medical Association was a single comment in his memoirs. Quote, "In their enthusiasm and curiosity, the doctors had forgotten that I was someone like themselves." Unquote. Although Blackburn and Casey still called one another friends for the remaining 3 years the Caseys would live in Bowling Green, Edgar never again submitted himself to the committee for a reading, and the committee subsequently disbanded. The injuries that Edgar sustained from the experimentation took months to heal, and the cuts under his nail left his finger disfigured for the rest of his life. Had this been the last of the misfortunes visited upon Edgar and his family, he might never have left Bowling Green. But 3 days before Christmas in 1906, while Edgar was still in the midst of recovering from the committee's last experiment, an arsonist set fire to the State Street studio, burning the building to the ground. The State Street fire was devastating to Casey and his family. Insurance paid for the loss of his photography equipment, but not for the thousands of dollars worth of artwork that was on consignment from a New York gallery. Had Edgar actually purchased the prints, his insurance policy would have covered the loss. Because they were on consignment, the photographer and his partners owed the New York gallery $8,000. Since the Hill had been mortgaged to finance the studio, Edgar had to pay the money or risk his in-laws losing their home. The pressure was especially intense on 27-year-old Gertrude, for not only was her family house at risk of foreclosure, but she was 6 months pregnant. To help out, Gertrude's mother came from Hopkinsville, and she and the Casey family moved together to a less expensive rental on the corner of Main Street and Park Avenue. It was at the Main Street house where Gertrude gave birth on March 16, 1907, to the boy they named Hugh Lynn, after both of Gertrude's brothers. While Gertrude and her mother looked after the baby, Edgar moved his operation into his other photography studio and worked more hours than ever before. In September of 1907, hardship would plague the family once again with another unexplained fire, this time at the College Street studio. No mention was made in correspondence or diaries as to what caused the second fire. All the historical record reveals is that Frank Potter, Edgar's partner at this time, decided to bail out of the photography business altogether. The Salters took out another loan against the Hill and bought out Potter's interest in the studio to keep the bank from foreclosing on the property. The studio was legally closed for the 7 minutes it took Potter to sign off and Dr. and Mrs. Thomas House to sign on as new partners. Dr. House temporarily moved to Bowling Green to help Edgar as the new manager of the studio. Besides assisting Edgar at the studio, he also began to conduct Edgar's trance sessions. These weren't, however, medical readings. They were almost exclusively on methods to help Edgar and the Salters out of their financial bind. Edgar's father, Leslie, who paid a visit to Edgar in Bowling Green, also wanted to try his hand at using the readings to raise funds. He formed a business syndicate with a few Hopkinsville associates. Their aim was to use psychic information to make money on the commodities market. Edgar agreed to help, on the condition that a percentage of what was gained would be put toward alleviating his and Gertrude's substantial debt. Leslie conducted readings in Bowling Green and wired the information to his partners in Hopkinsville, who traded on the Chicago commodities market. The first week reportedly generated several hundred dollars. The second week was apparently profitable enough that the investors left their jobs in Hopkinsville and moved their operation to Chicago, where they would be closer to the trading floor. At this point, the readings insisted that a man named Leiter would corner the wheat market. The trading price would go up to $1.19 and then break very suddenly, dropping down several points. Leslie's partners, who were certain that this couldn't be the case, failed to act accordingly and allegedly lost their syndicate's entire holdings. In the midst of giving this series of commodities readings, Edgar's friend Joe Dickey attempted to persuade Edgar that easy money could be made using his psychic gifts. Among other schemes, he talked Edgar into giving a reading on the races at Latona. In the course of a test reading, Casey was alleged to have correctly named 6 winners in 7 races. The only race in which he hadn't called a winner was one that Casey, in trance, had said was fixed and couldn't be called. Dickey was so excited by the success of the experiment that they took the train to Cincinnati and went to the races. Dickey put up the front money. This time, the reading indicated that only 4 out of the 7 races that day were not already fixed. Dickey bet and won in each instance. Edgar's share of the take was enough to get him out of debt, but the price he paid was higher than he or Dickey could have imagined. The trance readings could be a Pandora's box for anyone who chose to ignore the advice, take the information lightly, or use it in ways that were not in accord with its purposes and ideals. 2 months after giving the Latona readings, Dickey went on a 2-year leave from the university to undergo psychiatric therapy. Edgar also suffered, but the price he paid was not apparent until a short time later when he tried to give a reading for Hugh Evans, Gertrude's brother, who had been diagnosed with tuberculosis. Edgar was unable to go into trance. Dr. House repeatedly attempted to guide Edgar into trance and obtain a reading, as did Lynn Evans, John Blackburn, and Al Lane. But no matter how hard they tried, Edgar either developed a migraine headache or fell asleep. He couldn't give a reading for Hugh Evans, nor could he help anyone else who came to him, no matter how genuine their need. The source had become silent. To Edgar, this was a clear message that he was being punished for putting his own and others' material concerns above the greater spiritual good that could come through the readings. He believed that he had squandered God's gifts, as he called them, by putting them to the wrong use. Despondent, Edgar closed his Bowling Green studio, returned to the hill, and sought consolation and refuge through Bible study. As the weeks turned into months, Edgar increasingly despaired that he had accomplished nothing in his life, that he would never again be able to give readings, and that he would continually have to accept charity from his in-laws. He decided to look for paid employment, and in June of 1909 obtained work in Gadsden, Alabama, for a photographer named Harding. Edgar bade Gertrude and Hugh Lynn goodbye, promising to send for them as soon as he had become established. In Gadsden, Edgar began as a roving photographer, traveling from one school classroom to another. There were long, lonely trips between towns. He says he worked with 2 ambitions in mind: to heal his body, mind, and soul, and to have his own studio again. In this prayerful, meditative state of mind, and focused on the good that might again come from using his talents to help people in need, Edgar was again able to go into trance. He had just moved from Gadsden to Anniston, Alabama, where he had taken a higher-paying job at the Russell Brothers studio. The subject of his reading was a child named Gordon Putnam, whose mother and father had known Edgar in Bowling Green, and with the help of Leslie, had tracked him down in Anniston. Leslie had told the parents that Edgar had lost his powers, but at their insistence, traveled with them to Alabama to see if something couldn't be done to help their son. The reading took place on July 17th. Leslie conducted. Gordon Putnam had a serious motor coordination problem, which prevented him from being able to move his legs. Casey prescribed osteopathic treatments to be conducted by a physician named Tom Posey, who implemented the treatments and was able to effect a cure. Dr. Posey was quite beside himself and began to refer all his patients to Casey. Among them was a blind woman suffering from glaucoma who had 2 readings and was reportedly cured by the treatments recommended. It was also during this period that Casey is believed to have done what may well have been the first reading on what was later to become known as the work. Casey was asked where the best location was for him to conduct trance readings and how he could best be of service to mankind. Casey, in trance, said that his contribution to God's work wasn't truly going to begin in Kentucky or Alabama, but in Dayton, Ohio, and that it would not reach its fruition until he was in Virginia Beach, Virginia. Unfortunately for Edgar, the return of his ability to give readings was too late to help his brother-in-law, Hugh Evans. A number of readings were conducted on his behalf, and Gertrude and her mother visited Texas to try to nurse him back to health, but tuberculosis would soon claim his life. Edgar stayed in Anniston with the Russell brothers until July 4, 1910, when he and his father moved to Jacksonville, Alabama, to open a branch studio for them. He moved once again later that year, this time to Montgomery, Alabama, where he took a job with the Tressler Company, a large studio syndicate operated by Sidney Tressler, one of the best-known and most respected photographers in the southern United States. As Edgar's new address became known, many of the doctors who had consulted him in Bowling Green, Hopkinsville, and Anniston would once again come to him for help with their patients. Among them was Dr. Wesley Ketchum, a young Hopkinsville homeopath who requested that Edgar return home to conduct readings for three of his patients. Enclosed with the letter from Ketchum was a round-trip railroad ticket home. Edgar agreed, but still wary of involving himself in giving any readings that were not medically related, first obtained Ketchum's solemn promise that readings were to be given for sick people only. Ketchum agreed, and the readings were scheduled to begin in late August. The first reading Casey provided to Ketchum was for a boy with an obstinate leg sore. The reading advised using oil of smoke. Thinking this was a commercial preparation, Ketchum did not ask where the product might be found. A search of the local drugstores didn't turn it up, nor could it be found in pharmaceutical catalogs. A second reading was taken, in which Ketchum asked where he could locate oil of smoke. Casey named a drugstore in Louisville, but when Ketchum wired the drugstore, the manager informed him that they did not have oil of smoke, and in fact had never heard of it. A third reading was taken. This time, Casey described the back room of the Louisville drugstore, named a shelf, and said that behind a particular item on this shelf, there was a bottle of oil of smoke. Ketchum wired the instructions to the manager of the drugstore. He received a brief reply. Found it. The label was discolored and faded, and the company that had prepared it was no longer in business, but, sure enough, the product was billed as oil of smoke, a trade name used for oil that had been filtered through smoke from burning wood. Ketchum also used Casey to diagnose a problem of his own. For years he had been suffering from attacks of severe pain in his lower abdomen. The symptoms indicated an appendicitis, a diagnosis that was supported by two fellow doctors. Before the operation, however, he wanted a reading. Casey said that although he would someday have to undergo a very painful and difficult appendix operation, his present malady was the result of having wrenched his spine a few years earlier. The earlier injury, Casey reported, had put undue pressure on his last dorsal vertebra. Ketchum followed the recommended treatment and had no further trouble. Years later, Ketchum did in fact have his appendix removed, and as Casey had said in his earlier reading, it proved to be an extremely difficult operation. Despite their early success in working together, Edgar didn't much care for Ketchum's company, and the two men traveled in completely separate social and religious circles. Ketchum's primary personal interest was in gaining social prominence and power, as evidenced by his almost pathological desire to be accepted into the Hopkinsville chapter of the Elks Club. Ketchum himself later admitted that he resorted to blackmail to become a member, availing himself of personal information about committee members that he had obtained through Casey in trance to further his cause. Edgar hadn't the slightest interest in the Elks Club or any of the other popular social organizations in Hopkinsville. He also wasn't particularly concerned with or interested in who Ketchum's patients were and what treatments they were receiving. He accepted the train ticket Ketchum sent him, gave the readings that were requested, and then headed directly to the hill to see Gertrude and Hugh Lynn. This, and photographing Halley's Comet, were Edgar's only preoccupations during his first trip home from Montgomery, Alabama. Edgar exhibited such lack of interest in Ketchum's activities that he wasn't particularly surprised or annoyed when Ketchum didn't call him for the rest of the summer. The reason was that Ketchum had attended a meeting of the National Society of Homeopathic Physicians which was held at the California Institute of Technology, or Caltech, in Pasadena, California. Here, Ketchum presented a paper that he and a colleague had been working on for over a year. The subject of the paper was Edgar Cayce and his psychic abilities, and it triggered a nationwide sensation in the medical community. Edgar didn't hear about the paper until 3 months later, and by then, he and Ketchum were national celebrities. Edgar would find out about his new status on October 10, 1910, when he returned to the Tressler studio after a photography assignment and found a newspaper reporter waiting to interview him. "You're famous," the reporter announced, showing him a day-old copy of the New York Times. The front-page headline read, "Illiterate Man Becomes a Doctor When Hypnotized." The article described Cayce's precocious behavior as a child and his strange ability to learn the contents of books by sleeping on them. It went on to describe how he had lost and regained his voice and began to diagnose other people's illnesses. Ketchum was quoted as saying, "His psychological terms and description of the nervous anatomy would do credit to any professor of nervous anatomy, and there is no faltering in his speech, and all his statements are clear and concise. He handles the most complex jawbreakers with as much ease as any Boston physician, which to me is quite wonderful, in view of the fact that while in his normal state, he is an illiterate man, especially along the line of medicine, surgery, or pharmacy, of which he knows nothing." Unquote. Edgar felt insulted that he was being called an illiterate. However, he felt a certain gratification that nationally recognized doctors and other professionals believed there was substance to what Ketchum had said about him. In the article, Ketchum provided a possible explanation for Cayce's powers, which he claimed to have obtained from Cayce while in a trance. His statement has since become the most quoted explanation of Cayce's psychic talents. He said that Cayce's mind is amenable to suggestion, the same as all other subconscious minds. But in addition thereto, it has the power to interpret to the objective mind of others what it acquires from the subconscious mind of other individuals. This is the end of Side 3. Please turn over the tape for proper cueing of Side 4.